Thank you very much. Thank you, Karen. Thank you for that nice introduction. So it's a pleasure for me to be here. And I want to say it's a special thrill and honor for me to be here alongside Don Cohn. One of my only regrets about coming to the Fed, other than maybe the dress code, is my timing. I wish I'd had the good sense to get here a few years earlier so I could have had Don as a colleague and had the opportunity to learn from him. Now the only way I get to learn from him is indirectly. It's notable that some of the best advice I've gotten from people at the board since I've joined has often come in the form of, here's what Don Cohn would have done in this situation. So, Don, indirectly, thank you very much, and I look forward to our discussion. So what I was hoping to do was to take this opportunity to describe the framework I've been using to think about monetary policy in the current environment and focusing primarily on the role of large-scale asset purchases. Before doing so, let me just note the usual disclaimer. The thoughts I'm about to give you are my own and do not necessarily reflect the views of others on the FOMC. There's a considerable diversity of views within the FOMC and within among economists more generally about the use of large-scale asset purchases, LSAPs, and other unconventional policy tools. And this is both inevitable and healthy given the unprecedented circumstances in which we find ourselves. Let me be clear on where I stand. I support the committee's decision of last month, namely to initiate purchases of mortgage-backed securities, MBS, at a rate of $40 billion a month, in tandem with the ongoing maturity extension program of Treasury securities, and to plan to continue those purchases if the committee does not observe a substantial improvement in the labor market outlook. Given where we are and given what we know, I firmly believe that this was the right decision. In my comments today, I'm only going to briefly review the case for taking that action, as that ground has been well covered, most notably in Chairman Bernanke's recent Jackson Hole speech. Instead, I'm going to explore in more detail the factors that make decisions about LSAP so challenging. The chairman discussed these challenges in his recent speech, saying, estimates of the effects of non-traditional policies on economic activity and inflation are uncertain, and the use of non-traditional policies involves costs beyond those generally associated with more standard policies. Consequently, the bar for use of non-traditional policies is higher than that for traditional policies. Okay? So with that principle in mind, my aim here is to lay out the thought process that I'm bringing to bear in an effort to decide just how high the bar should be and whether a proposed action clears that bar. Along the way, I hope to highlight some gaps in economists' collective understanding of LSAPs and maybe to provoke a little bit of further research on some of these questions. But let me start by setting the context. The point of departure for any analysis of monetary policy is our dual mandate to foster maximum employment and price stability. And in my view, the first pass here is pretty clear. That is to say, unemployment remains painfully high, and in my opinion, well above the long-run structural rate of unemployment. Moreover, if you smooth through the sort of inevitable ups and downs of incoming data, it appears that the economy is growing at such a pace that absent policy action, progress on reducing unemployment will likely be slow for some time. In the meantime, inflation is subdued, running at or below our long-run objective of 2%, while longer-run inflation expectations remain well anchored. So if the federal funds rate were, say, at 3%, we would have, in my view, an open and shut case for lowering it. Now, the complication, of course, is that the funds rate is essentially at its lower bound, which means we can't turn that dial further. Instead, we have to use unconventional tools, such as LSAPs, and guidance about the future path of the funds rate. With respect to LSAPs, my belief, and this echoes the views that Chairman Bernanke expressed at Jackson Hole, is that prior rounds of LSAPs have played a significant role in supporting activity and in preventing a worrisome undershoot of our inflation objective. And the case is especially strong with respect to the first round of LSAPs, which was a very potent piece of policy action that helped to bring the economy back from the brink in 2009. However, we now face a harder set of questions, not about the value of past LSAPs, but about the marginal costs and benefits of future LSAPs. A number of observers have raised concerns about either diminishing returns or escalating costs. I think that at least in the limit, these concerns must be right. We could in principle push this tool to the point that the hurdle for additional usage would become very high. As policymakers, I believe it's our responsibility to be as clear as possible about the nature of these costs and benefits and how they might evolve. So in that spirit, I'm going to try in what follows to outline the mechanisms that can give rise to either decreasing marginal efficacy of LSAPs or to increasing marginal costs. Now, while much of my discussion is going to focus on what you might call the direct hydraulic effects of LSAPs on the economy, it should be emphasized that their overall impact can be augmented via what you might call a signaling or a confidence channel. That is to say, another important tool in the committee's arsenal these days is its use of forward guidance about the expected path of the funds rate. And a change in this guidance was a key part of the September FOMC statement, with the committee stating that a highly accommodative stance of monetary policy will remain appropriate for a considerable time after the economic recovery strengthens. And I believe that the LSAP component of the statement helped to bolster the credibility of the forward guidance component by pairing an immediate and concrete set of actions with a statement about future intentions. And I suspect that this complementarity helps us to understand the relatively strong reaction of the stock market, for example, in the immediate wake of the release of the statement in September. Now, in addition to the signaling channel, LSAPs also, as I just said, have a variety of direct effects on the economy. Now, to better understand these effects, it's useful to compare them with those that make monetary policy work in normal times. Away from the zero lower bound, monetary policy is typically thought to work through an expectations channel. That is to say, when the Fed cuts the funds rate, long-term rates also fall, primarily because expectations of future short-term rates are moving down as well. Okay? Now, by contrast, a principal motive for doing LSAPs is to influence interest rates not through just expectations, but through effectively just direct supply and demand effects in the long-term bond market. Okay? As the Fed buys more long-term bonds, their price goes up and their yield falls, even holding fixed expectations about the future path of short-term rates. Another way to say the same thing is that the so-called term premium on long-term bonds declines, which is just a sort of jargony way of saying that after an LSAP, long-term bonds are expected to perform less well as an investment relative to short-term. So there's a relative price pressure mechanism. Now, there's a large body of evidence building that suggests that LSAPs do, in fact, exert significant pressure in this way on long-term treasury yields. So, you know, estimates of the cumulative effect, so this is starting with QE1 and through the present, estimates of the cumulative effect of past LSAPs on 10-year treasury yields are in the range of 80 to 120 basis points. And these past actions are one reason why treasury term premiums are now near historic lows. And, you know, these are somewhat model-dependent, but according to one well-known model that is used by Fed staff, the term premium is in the neighborhood of minus 80 basis points. So here's the central theme, or a central theme of my talk today, which is the following. When policy works by moving term premia, as opposed to by simply shifting the expectations about the path of short rates, the transmission to the real economy can be altered in subtle but important ways. Okay? And these differences can have implications for the benefits of a policy action, for its costs, and even its consequences for financial stability. Okay? Moreover, to really address these issues, we need to understand not only the hydraulic question of how much an LSAP moves term premia, but also the underlying economics of why it does so. Okay? And I should just note that in many macro models, this distinction that I'm making between moving rates via expectations versus moving rates via term premia is essentially set aside. So, for example, in the board staff's main workhorse model, the FRB-US model, a fall in the long-term rate is assumed to have the same effect on economic activity, irrespective of whether that fall in the rate was caused by a change in expectations of future short rates or caused by a move in the term premium. Okay. So for the sake of concreteness in what follows, let's just think this is purely a hypothetical, but let's think in terms of a $500 billion LSAP conducted entirely by buying long-term treasuries. Later, I'll come back and I'll speak to the differences that arise when the LSAP is conducted with mortgage-backed securities instead. But for concreteness, I'll start with Treasuries. A reasonable estimate based on the empirical literature would be that such a program reduces the term premium and thus the 10-year Treasury yield by something on the order of 15 to 20 basis points. That would be the effect of an incremental $500 billion. Now, in my mind, this is the best empirically understood and least controversial piece of the transmission mechanism, not surprisingly, because we can observe relatively directly the effects on rates. And moreover, I should say I have no reason to expect diminishing efficacy on this particular piece of the transmission mechanism. All evidence suggests that the past is likely to be a reasonably good guide to future outcomes here. Now, of course, this evidence on the direct Treasury market impact is just a starting point. To fully evaluate the effects of an LSAP, one needs to take several further steps, some of which are more open to debate. In so doing, it's helpful to clarify the specifics of the supply-demand story. Now, one version of this story works through the market price of duration risk, which is another word for the interest rate risk borne by an investor in long-term bonds. Now, in this version of the story, all bonds, be it treasury bonds, corporate bonds, mortgage-backed securities, can roughly be thought of as close substitutes for one another. And an LSAP, by reducing the total quantity of interest rate risk or duration risk in private hands, lowers the price of this risk and thereby lowers the yields on all bonds, roughly speaking, by an amount proportional to their duration. Okay? Going further, you might argue that to the extent that equities, as a long-term asset, also embed some duration risk, the return investors require to hold them should fall commensurately, thus giving a significant boost to stock prices. However, in other versions of the story, markets are somewhat more segmented, and treasuries and other bonds are not such close substitutes for one another. There's effectively separate investors who hold the different assets. In such a case, an LSAP would have differential effects, and an LSAP that absorbs treasury supply might be expected to lower the yields on treasuries relative to the yields on other assets, or alternatively to increase the treasury corporate spread or to increase the treasury MBS spread. And a similar logic would say in this case that an LSAP might have only a more modest effect on stock prices. Okay? So with this as a backdrop, let me start with the efficacy side of the question. So take our $500 billion LSAP, and as mentioned earlier, let's just stipulate, based on the evidence in the literature, that it's going to reduce the 10-year Treasury yield by 20 basis points. Now, a simple way to proceed would be to essentially plug this 20 basis point change into one of our macroeconometric models and ask what are the consequences that emerge for GDP growth and for unemployment. Now, just to be concrete, if you did this exercise with the Fed's workhorse FRB US model, it would tell you that a $500 billion LSAP, which moves the 10-year Treasury rate by 20 basis points, should be expected to bring down unemployment by approximately 0.2 of a percentage point at a 2-year horizon. This is an economically meaningful effect. So naturally, all models rely on a host of assumptions, so the true effect could be larger or smaller than what comes out of the FRB US or any model in that vein. But I would like to focus on two sources of uncertainty in particular. A first uncertainty relates to a point that I mentioned, which is that a given impact on Treasury bonds may not pass through fully to other rates that are more relevant for consumption investment decisions such as corporate bond rates or primary mortgage market rates. Now, if you read the recent academic literature on this question, it seems somewhat divided. Some papers argue effectively that the pass-through is quite strong, near 100%. Others argue that it's quite low. My own kind of attempt at synthesizing this evidence is that, thus far, there's been fairly substantial pass-through from LSAPs to things like corporate bonds and to mortgages. Somewhat less, but considerably less, pass through to more distant asset categories like, for example, equities. That's kind of my reading. Now, leaving aside this one set of complications, so that we suppose that a $500 billion LSAP will have a 20 basis point impact not only on Treasury rates but on, say, corporate bond rates, there's a second and I think maybe more fundamental issue. How should a how should we expect a company to respond? How should we expect a company to respond when its long-term borrowing costs fall, but they fall not because of a change in the expected path of short-run rates, but rather they fall because of a change in the term premium? As I noted before, many macro models assume that the effect will simply be the same. But is there any reason to believe that in reality the response to the two types of movements in rates might differ? A basic corporate finance analysis suggests the answer may be yes. To see why, let me suggest the following example. Imagine a firm that faces a rate on its 10-year bonds of 2%. Okay, so the long-term rate is 2%. At the same time, that firm's expectation of the rolled-over sequence of short rates is 3%. So that's what I mean by a 1% term premium. Okay, long rate is 2%. The expected path of the short rate is 3%. Okay, so there's a term premium of minus 1%. So what should this firm do? Well, clearly, it feels like it should take advantage of the cheap long-term debt by issuing long-term bonds. But it's less obvious that this bargain 2% rate on these long-term bonds should exert an influence on its capital spending plans. Okay? After all, it can take the proceeds of the bond issue and use these to pay down short-term debt, to repurchase its stock, to buy short-term securities, that is to say, to make a variety of capital structure adjustments as opposed to just capital spending changes. And these capital structure adjustments implicitly yield an effective return of 3%. You can see that most clearly in the case when it basically issues the long-term bond and uses the proceeds to invest to pay down short-term debt, let's say. Okay? As a result, the hurdle rate for new investment might remain pinned at 3% even as the long-term bond rate continues to fall. So as a result, at least in this highly stylized example, the negative term premium matters a lot for financing behavior, but investment spending is somewhat decoupled from the incremental movements in the term premium and is instead more influenced by the expected path of short-term rates as opposed to simply the long-term rate. So this is, in my view, the reasoning that suggests why one might, in principle, think that future rounds of LSAPs might be expected to have diminishing returns. Okay? As I noted above, the data are quite clear that past rounds of LSAPs have pushed down rates and have pushed down term premia, but this argument would suggest that the further term premia are driven into negative territory, the more the previous logic comes into play, and hence the weaker is likely to be the response of aggregate spending to further downward pressure on long-term rates. Okay? This corporate finance example is also consistent with what we have observed in markets in recent months. Issuance of both investment-grade and high-yield bonds has been robust. In fact, domestic non-financial corporate bond issuance is on pace to set a record in 2012, and the speculative grade, the high-yield segment, may also register a new high for the year. At the same time, a large fraction of this issuance has been devoted to refinancing, either to retiring existing debt or to payouts to equity holders via either dividends or stock buybacks. These uses of proceeds have accounted for about two-thirds of all issuance by speculative-grade firms so far this year. And as I've tried to suggest, such patterns are what one would expect in a world of segmented markets and negative term premiums. This caveat about the diminishing effectiveness of LSAPs can be thought of as a specific version of what's sometimes referred to as Goodhart's Law. It may be that under normal circumstances, changes in 10-year rates have significant explanatory power for economic activity, perhaps in part because they're a proxy for the expected future path of the short rate or for other aspects of financial conditions. But it doesn't follow that when one sets out to influence the 10-year rate directly via asset purchases without changing the future path of the short rate, that the usual historical relationships will continue to apply. While we should acknowledge these doubts, it's also important to keep them in perspective. In addition to lowering interest rates, LSAPs also boost equity prices and other asset values. Taken together, these effects of LSAPs seem likely to be meaningful, even if the benefits of a given impetus to rates are less than in the baseline scenario sketched above. And to be sure, there's a wide confidence interval around any estimate we might make of the benefits. Moreover, it's worth repeating a point made earlier, which is whatever direct hydraulic effects LSAPs have by pushing down term premium and discount rates, their overall effect may be substantially reinforced via a signaling effect whereby they enhance the credibility of forward guidance about the future path of the funds rate. Indeed, the signaling benefit strikes me as an important part of the argument for LSAPs in the current environment. Okay, let me now turn to the cost side of the equation. Several potential costs of LSAPs have been discussed by others. One is the exit problem, namely that a large balance sheet may make it harder for the FOMC to raise rates when the time comes. Between the ability to pay interest on reserves, as well as various reserve draining methods that the Fed has been methodically testing, I'm confident that we have the tools to raise rates. If the FOMC needs to act in the face of an emerging threat to price stability, there's little doubt in my mind that we can. As to whether we will, the Federal Reserve has repeatedly made clear its commitment to both sides of its mandate, to price stability as well as to maximum employment. A second set of costs has to do with the possible effects of further asset purchases on various aspects of market function, including bid-ask spreads and market depth. And it would indeed be a concern if large Fed ownership of subsegments of the Treasury or MBS market were to cause market liquidity to deteriorate significantly. We've seen little evidence of such problems thus far, and we continue to closely monitor market conditions. If problems do begin to crop up, we will know it and we'll be able to adjust. A final notion of cost relates to the currently low yields and term premiums on Treasury bonds that I've been alluding to. At an intuitive level, one might think that for the Fed, as for any other buyer contemplating a large asset purchase, information on prices and expected returns should be a relevant factor in the decision. Said differently, the case for an LSAP might seem more appealing if the term premium on Treasury bonds was plus 200 basis points instead of its current level of roughly minus 80 basis points. However, this turns out to be a little subtle, and to make sense of this intuition, we have to return to the underlying question of why LSAPs move term premium. One interesting, and I would say admittedly speculative possibility, is that in a world where other sovereign debt has come into question, long-term treasuries, the reason that they're valued so highly, is that they're uniquely able to provide a money-like safe haven to certain investors. And by analogy here, think of currency, which investors are willing to hold at a low, in fact zero yield, because the flow of services, of convenient services that currency provides. Similarly, the negative term premium on long-term treasuries may in part reflect the scarcity of this money-like asset. If so, it would be economically costly to remove treasuries from the system. And this logic is really an application of what is often called the Friedman Rule, in honor of Milton Friedman. So a key question is to what extent this analogy holds, that is to say, to what extent is it the case that removing treasuries is like removing currency? This is a hard question to answer, and it turns out to depend on the details of how you tell the story. If you believe that only nominal treasuries, but not something similar like agency securities or AAA corporate bonds, if only nominal treasuries provide money-like services to investors, you can try to measure the value of these money-like services by looking at the spread on a treasury bond relative to something else that's very safe, but not exactly a treasury bond. So, for example, you could look at corporate bonds coupled with a credit default swap to eliminate the credit risk. Arvind Krishnamurthy and Annette Vissing-Jorgensen at Northwestern University have done a study along these lines, and their conclusion is that between 24 and 70 basis points of the yield premium on treasuries is attributable to this money-like effect. Numbers in this ballpark suggest that the cost of further LSAPs on this dimension are likely to be non-zero, but modest relative to even a conservative estimate of their potential benefits. Now, a couple of caveats are worth noting. First, this methodology probably provides a lower bound on the costs of an LSAP, since it's plausible that not only treasuries, but also agency securities and AAA corporate bonds could have some degree of moneyness to them, in which case a spread of the sort that I've just described might conceivably underestimate the value of the monetary services provided by safe and near safe assets. So as I mentioned before, in terms of future research, this area is one in particular where both our conceptual understanding and our measurement techniques remain somewhat underdeveloped, and where more work would be of great value in informing policy. Second point to note is that things can change over time. One episode of interest is the Clinton-era debt buyback program, which in many ways was analogous to an LSAP. As many of you might remember, between early 2000 and late 2001, the Treasury repurchased long-term bonds with a face value of $63.5 billion, which was about 10% of the then outstanding stock of Treasury securities. Much as with an LSAP, this repurchase program appears to have had a powerful negative effect on the term premium, with long-term rates falling sharply relative to short-term rates. But in contrast to what we've seen with an LSAP, with LSAPs thus far, it was also associated with what appeared to be a quite pronounced increase in Treasury-specific scarcity. And one way this scarcity manifested itself at the time was a widening, and this is a little bit of a techie thing, was in the widening of something called the Treasury swap spread, which rose to something like 120 to 130 basis points in the spring of 2000. We have not seen anything like that in the current environment. So the lesson I just want to highlight is that we should continue to develop and monitor a variety of metrics of the scarcity phenomenon, because they may be helpful on a going forward basis in terms of providing an early warning if LSAP costs do begin to rise relative to benefits. Now, for the sake of concreteness, I've been talking in terms of a hypothetical all-Treasury LSAP. In light of our recent initiation of MBS purchases, it's natural to ask what the salient differences are between buying Treasuries and buying MBS. In my view, there are two, both of which suggest that MBS purchases may offer a better cost-benefit profile than Treasuries, at least in the current environment. First, on the cost side, I just alluded to the idea that Treasuries may provide money-like safe haven services to certain investors, such that removing them from the system could entail a cost. Presumably, MBS are somewhat less money-like than Treasuries, so this element of cost would be reduced when buying MBS. Second, if the efficacy of Treasury purchases is diminished by the fact that many corporate borrowers already have plentiful access to low-cost funds, it's natural to focus on a sector that is more sensitive to financing costs. And the housing market would arguably fit this bill in the current environment. So to the extent, and this relies on market segmentation, but to the extent that markets are segmented and MBS purchases therefore have a more direct and powerful effect on primary mortgage rates than do Treasury purchases, this possibility might be another appeal of going the MBS route. Finally, let me touch on the implications of LSAPs for financial stability. Some observers have argued that a long period of low rates can create an incentive among market participants, such as banks, insurance companies, pension funds, to reach for yield by taking on higher levels of risk with potentially adverse consequences for stability. These concerns should be taken very seriously, and there's a lot of work ongoing at the Fed devoted to monitoring such risks. A short summary would be to say that there is some qualitative evidence of reaching for yield behavior in certain segments of the market, but we're not seeing anything quantitatively alarming at this point. Of course, the worry is that one often sees the tip of the iceberg in these kind of situations, so one needs to be always careful in interpreting the data. But taking as given that reaching for yield could be a problem, what are the implications at the margin for monetary policy and for LSAPs in particular? First, it's just a fact of life that we're likely to be in a low-rate environment for a considerable period of time, given the economic outlook. It's not a choice at the margin. While we're going to have to pay careful attention to the attendant financial stability issues and be prepared to intervene with supervisory and regulatory tools as needed, I would find it hard to accept the proposition that we should attempt to preemptively resolve them by, say, starting to raise the federal funds rate today. The potential damage that could be caused by choking off the recovery is too great. Second, one can argue that by reducing term premiums, LSAPs in particular have potentially significant benefits in terms of financial stability. If you think about the recent crisis, a major source of problems was excessive maturity transformation by financial firms. That is to say, these firms relied too much on short-term debt. And one of the thrusts of regulatory reform has been an effort to attack this problem with regulation, for example, via the constructs of the liquidity coverage ratio and the net stable funding ratio that are part of Basel III. However, a complementary way to deal with the maturity transformation problem is to influence the underlying incentives for short-term debt issuance. And these incentives are in turn shaped by the structure of rates and the structure of term premiums in the market. As I noted earlier, a natural response for any firm facing an unusually low term premium is a financing response. That is to say, it makes sense to alter your capital structure by issuing cheaper long-term debt to replace your short-term debt. It's therefore not surprising that if you look at the data, the average debt maturity of large non-financial firms has increased notably in the last few years. It's a natural response to the rate environment. Moreover, the same pattern shows up among large financial firms. They, too, have been significantly lengthening their average debt maturity. Now, it should be noted that the current cheapness of long-term debt contrasts with the pre-crisis configuration, where there was frequently a pronounced advantage favoring issuers not at the long end of the yield curve, but at the very short end. In other words, the fact that the yield curve often tended to be steeply upward sloping at the very front end tended to give financial firms a strong incentive to issue overnight paper. The bottom line of this is that I suspect that LSAPs have, by changing the structure of term premium in the market, helped to encourage an extension of debt maturity by both financial and non-financial firms. And all else being equal, I think this development is a good thing from a financial stability perspective. Okay, let me conclude. Just to restate, I believe that our recently announced policy of MBS purchases, coupled with the change in our forward guidance, that these are strong positive steps. I'm hopeful that these actions by the Federal Reserve will help to give economic growth a much-needed boost. At the same time, I'm keenly aware of the many uncertainties we still have about the workings of non-conventional policies and of LSAPs in particular. As I've tried to explain, LSAPs really are something of a different animal, and it is important for us to try to better understand these differences and to do our best to take them into account when making policy judgments. In short, there's a lot left for us to still learn. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy. That was a very thoughtful and thought-provoking talk. I, too, am sorry we didn't overlap at the board, and I think most of the learning would have come from going in that direction. Let me start off with a few questions arising out of the talk.